Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Your Ben Jarofsky Show for Tuesday, January 20th. That's going to be a long day today. All right. Your Ben Jarofsky Show for Tuesday, January 20th is just moments away. But before we get into that, we need to thank the following unions for jumping on board and sponsoring this program. Unions like the International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers, Local 126 in District 8, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, Local 9, the International Union of Operating Engineers, Local 150, sponsor this program, as well as our good friends at the Chicago Federation of Labor. Ben Jarofsky, hit us with that song of the day.
Love is in the air. Yeah, baby, love is in the air. I'm feeling it, all right?
He's feeling it, guys. The Ben Jarofsky Show starts now. It is Tuesday, January 21st. And live from the Chicago Sun-Times Chicago Reader Studio on Racine Avenue, this is the Ben Jarofsky Show. Today on the program, our Chicago Reader colleague Maya Duke-Masova will join us, and it's the long-awaited return of President of the Chicago Principals Association, our good friend Troy LaRavier. And now your host, the long-awaited return, Chicago Reader columnist Ben Jarofsky.
Hello, everybody. Ben Jarofsky here. We're calling this Hand-Holding Tuesday. That's what we're calling it. And here's why. Great week. You have a good weekend, D?
Yes, 3 days ago.
It was great. Had a great weekend, man. I saw Marriage Story. Got one word about Marriage Story. Right, got to prepare.
What is it called?
Marriage Story.
Oh, Marriage Story.
Yeah, what did you think I said?
Mayor Story? I don't know what you said.
No, Marriage Story. Now, we're having a show on January 29th. We're bringing all the smartest brains in the world about movies into the studio to talk about the great movies.
So I won't be talking.
You'll be here. Dennis, you've seen two of the big movies. No, one. You've seen Joker, that right?
Yeah, and Jojo Rabbit.
Oh, Jojo Rabbit. Yeah, Jojo was a man. Yeah, I like Jojo Rabbit a lot. Anyway, so to prepare for that, I'm still watching movies. To prepare for that discussion, had to watch Marriage Story. Got one word about Marriage Story. Overrated.
Oh.
All right. And then I watched Judy, which is a movie about Judy Garland. And I watched that because Renee Zellweger is up for Best Actress. And I got to tell you, folks, I hate to admit this, I was crying like a baby at that movie. I love that movie.
Ben.
Yeah, no, man. Judy Garland, I love Judy. I'm going to just say it, but put it out there. I love Judy Garland. Maya Dubasova in the studio. She loves Judy Garland, too. She's nodding her head. I'm not sure if Maya's ever seen a Judy Garland movie. Anyway, so then I woke up, and she's like, I have seen one. I woke up and discovered it was Martin Luther King Day, which is the one day of the year where people in the city of Chicago hold hands and say nice things about each other before they go back to fighting each other, gouging each other's eyes out, which is what they... And that's not even a full day that they do it, D. I think it's like for an hour at a breakfast that where all the movers and shakers of Chicago are invited. Were you invited to that breakfast, D?
No.
I don't think so.
Were you?
No. I've never been invited to the Martin Luther King Day. Never. Ever. Okay? You know, I go if invited. But actually, it's really early in the morning. Issues getting up. So, you know, they always forget, of course, that when Martin Luther King was alive and in full in power and glory, he came to Chicago to bring his movement for open housing and a more equitable distribution of money and end slums and spend money wisely, investing in people and neighborhoods that need it the most, as opposed to throwing it down the military industrial complex. When he was alive and strong and speaking for himself, Chicagoans showed how much love they have for Martin Luther King by hitting him in the head with a rock. All right? Isn't that funny? They love him now that he's not around, but they didn't like him very much when he was around and speaking from his heart. Anyway, so there was great examples in the newspaper today of people feeling that 1 hour of love that they feel one day a week, 1 hour of love, one hour of love, one day a year. There was a picture of Jesse Jackson and Richard Durbin, Senator Durbin, at the Martin Luther King breakfast that you were not invited to, Dee.
Nor are you.
nor was I. There's also a story, interesting story, a pro-gun rally of thousands in Virginia. And these are people that you would not normally associate with loving Martin Luther King. But I guess they were feeling the love. It's usually a bunch of white guys with guns saying how we need less laws restricting gun use because, why? Because guns, it's hard to get a gun. And I really don't understand the argument that they make. It seems pretty easy to get a gun. There sure certainly are a lot of guns in our society. Anyway, to show that they're not just all white guys, there was one black man at the rally, and this is what he had to say. I'm getting this from the Sun Times. I love this. This is like the Super Bowl for the Second Amendment right here, said PJ Hudson, a truck driver from Richmond who carried an AR-15 rifle just outside of Capitol Square. He was one of the few African-American rally goers in a crowd that was overwhelmingly white and male and was frequently stopped and asked to pose for pictures wearing his, quote, Black Guns Matter sweatshirt. So black guns matter, but black lives don't matter. I wonder if there was anybody at the pro-gun rally wearing a shirt that said black lives matter. But, you know, it was Martin Luther King Day. So even at the pro-gun rally, they were holding hands. And finally, Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren marched together arm in arm at the Martin Luther King March in South Carolina. And there's a photo in the paper of Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren shaking hands. So now she's taking his hand. All right. Last week we talked a lot about how she didn't want Bernie, put that big Bernie paw out there to shake hands with Elizabeth Warren after the debate. And Elizabeth Warren said, "No, you lied about me." And then Bernie said, "Oh, you lied about me." That's my Bernie.
It's getting better.
But who lied about me? We had LC in the studio last week.
Sounds a little like Scooby-Doo, but we're getting there.
Larry Cohen, who's in the studio, the guy loves Bernie more than anybody I've ever met. He sounds like Bernie.
Oh, yeah.
I'm Larry Cohen, and I approve of this ad. Anyway, so Bernie, and they're shaking hands now. I'm going to say something right here. I'm going to get all my Bernie bros mad at me. I've been warned by people, don't do it, Ben. You're going to get the Bernie bros mad at you. But you know what? I don't hate on Elizabeth Warren like Bernie bros do. Okay, D? I'm just putting that out there.
I'm so mad at you right now.
Bernie bros, oh, God damn, I've had enough of this guy. Listen, man, I'm going to throw this out to our mystery guest. We have a mystery guest in the studio. That's probably the person, if you're watching the live stream, you're wondering, who's the mystery guest? She's going to get this question. Here's the deal. My Bernie bro listeners are always telling me the reason they love Bernie so much is that Bernie has been saying the same thing for, 50 years. He hasn't deviated. He has a sense of what America, the direction America should go in, the laws he would pass and support if he were president, the kind of movement he would lead. He hasn't changed his tune. He doesn't bend with the breeze. He's fixed. And he has fixed principles that have governed him his entire political career, and I can appreciate that. And that's why Bernie's currently number one on my list of five, okay? That, you know, I got my top five. And in the Democratic nomination, the primary for the nomination. Anyway, on the other hand, they say, well, Elizabeth Warren, as of 1996, was a Republican. People, you know, I don't know if you know that, D. Elizabeth Warren was a Republican, and mm-hmm. She did not officially become a Democrat until 1996. Now, I could quickly point out that Bernie Sanders is not even officially a Democrat. He's a Democratic Socialist. Okay, just throwing that out there, Bernie bros, to make you feel a little happier. But I'm just throwing that out there, giving Elizabeth Warren a hard time because she didn't officially become a Democrat until 1996. So I look at it this way. Yes, it's true that Elizabeth Warren did not emerge into adulthood articulating the same views she's articulating now. But I can make an argument or case for evolving toward a position, like looking at the world and seeing everything that exists and realizing that maybe the worldview you had as a child and as a teenager and as a young mother and a law school professor was wrong. and that the world's different than you. So, and you have the flexibility, the nimbleness, the open-mindedness to change your position. And that's, and adopt a position that's more in line with what I believe in, progressive politics. So I'm going to make the argument that maybe it's just as heartfelt in Elizabeth Warren as it is for Bernie, because this is the worldview that she developed as she went through life. So I'm going to give her that shout out. I'm not a Elizabeth Warren hater, like many of my friends of the Bernie Bro persuasion. And I think she would be a great candidate for the Democrats. That said, that's one of the dumbest political moves of all time, not to shake Bernie's hand and to listen to whoever it was in the back rooms of your campaign telling you it was a good idea to try to get women to vote for you by playing that old tune about Bernie. By the way, you know someone else was not feeling the love yesterday? I should say it was Martin Luther King Day, and everybody was feeling love for everybody else. Hillary Clinton still has not made her amends with Bernie Sanders. She's still hating on Bernie. I don't know if you saw that interview. Anyway, she was ripping on Bernie pretty bad. So anyway, that's my thought. Elizabeth Warren, I'm feeling a little bit sympathetic for Elizabeth Warren these days. It was a rough week for her last week. She made a mistake. She listened to some of the people in the back room who think they know everything and don't really know a whole lot. And she paid for it. But they'll throw her under the bus, Bernie bros. All right. Show a little compassion for Elizabeth Warren. We got a great show today, everyone. Maya's here already. She's all fired up. I'm sure she's going to be giving me a piece of. We're going to be talking about the first congressional district. I may throw a Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren question to Maya, too. She's ready for that. Troy, she nods her head. Yeah, she's ready to rock and roll. Troy LaRavier will be in here, the head of the Chicago Principals Association, Bernie Sanders delegate in 2016. And get his thoughts on all the political views of the day. And we have a mystery guestie. Yeah,
really?
Yeah. In this studio. We have a mystery guest in this studio. Should I introduce our mystery guest?
A mystery guest, you say?
Yes. Thank you for playing that music. Should I introduce our mystery guest right now, or do we want to go to the news?
Well, as we spoke of before the show,
I forgot.
Pre-show prep. I knew you would. You do it now.
All right. So, mystery guest, introduce yourself.
Hi, I'm Rachel Ventura, and I'm running for Congress in the Congressional District of 11 of Illinois. And I want to mention something you said about MLK Day. So you talked about Bernie having 50 years. You know, he's continuing the movement that we saw that MLK did when he was not, well-liked when he was alive, and that is the Poor People's Campaign. You know, it is the democratic socialist that Bernie stands on today that came out of the movement of MLK. And he talked about the wealth inequalities and the right to have health care and how it wasn't just a racial issue. So tying all that together, wow, you really kicked at the Bernie bros on that one. And this is what I have to say. I see where you're coming from. And for people to consider where Warren came from, think of all of the people in her life, the friends, the family members who were Republicans who probably gave her a lot of heartache, and how she had to be not just a strong voice for the Democratic Party, but as a woman, you know, it's hard to speak out sometimes in society. And that's one of the things that she's showing other women that they get excited about. So you want to say, playing the gender card, well, that's where it is, where women feel that they want to have a voice too, and they want people who are going to be brave enough to speak up for them. And so what I see happening with the handshake and stuff is that as progressives, what we need to do is we need to come together and not let the Biden and Buttigieg wing of the party destroy us over the things that are not important. The things that are important are passing the Green New Deal, are getting Medicare for all. And this is where both Bernie and Elizabeth do stand, and they stand united. So it's nice to see them shaking hands. It's nice to see them walking together for a movement that's so important in this country that we need to continue to see that. So, yeah, I mean, when it comes down to that convention, we need all of our delegates, whether they're Bernie or Elizabeth, fighting for the progressive platform.
Yeah, and not have a situation like we had where Hillary Clinton, 4 years later, is still fighting the fight from 2016. And I understand why a lot of Hillary supporters are irritated at Bernie bros, because they said a lot of nasty things about Hillary during the campaign. But Bernie himself campaign that last month, definitely hard for Hillary Clinton, and not to show any love or appreciation for Bernie for what he did, I think is misguided on the part of Hillary Clinton.
Well, and the other thing that the DSA also stands for, which I really appreciate, is that they're all about inclusion, not exclusion. They want to have everybody at the table. So if we don't allow for people to adapt and come on board with the ideas, then we are turning that chair away from them, saying, no, you can't have a seat at our table because you're not a purist.
Yeah.
We don't want that, right? We want everyone to come and see. Like you said, why do you believe in this movement? Well, I believe because it invests in people, right? It closes that wealth gap. It provides policies that are fair for everyone, not just the millionaires or those who have bought, you know, access to lawmakers, but everybody in this country, a government that works for everyone. We want people to see that. We don't want them to get distracted on handshakes. We don't want them to be distracted on the he said, she said. We want them looking at the policies and say, you know what, that's a policy that will help my family. That's a policy that's going to lower my bills or increase my pay. And that's something that's going to help the quality of life I have.
All right. But the reality is, as you know, Rachel, is that political campaigns are won on all kinds of trivialities. And there is no doubt in my mind that Bernie and Elizabeth Warren's campaigns made huge mistakes in the last 2 weeks. One, Bernie with that elite thing where they were having their little robots reading, oh, you know, she's an elitist, blah, 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 which I thought was misguided. And that really irritated Elizabeth Warren. And then they came out with the cockamamie. He said a woman can't win. And so now they're like just pecking at each other. And it's, I swear, I have no proof of this. I got to say this. I have no proof, Rachel, that this is the case because I'm not in the back rooms, but it just sure smelled like a tactic that some little smarty pants who like, this is how we're going to win, Elizabeth Warren. We could just poke a little at the scabs and the wounds here and get some women to flip-flop from Bernie to, and it's like, what are you
thinking? Well, I think that's the thing that we should be discussing, the scabs and the wounds of the female audience out there. You know, we do have, I mean, I have a male campaign manager and we go back and forth on what the gender reality is. And I understand the fear that men have too, right? They don't want to be accused of something they haven't done. They don't want to stack the cards against them. I don't want that to happen either. But women also want to be heard and said, well, these are some things, some slights that we deal with on a daily basis. And here are some abuses we deal with too. And so the conversation we should be having is not, oh, how can we exploit this in a campaign and poke at each other? But what is it that female, you know, the individuals need to be heard, whether it's the males who are fearful of the swing of power. And there's some legitimacy there, too. I'm not trying to say that it's all made up or it's all concocted. But also, why is it that women feel that they haven't had accurate voice? And we don't get accurate time sometimes on the campaign. I've seen that. You know, the incumbents that I'm running against is a male. And so 23% of Congress are females. That means if you favor the incumbent, you've already favored the male side of the audience. So one of that is an uphill battle for women to fight. And so there are times that our voice is, we have to be louder, we have to be stronger, and then we have to make sure we're not judged by that because you get the electability part that comes up. But at the end of the day, we need our politics to be about policies and not about entertainment.
All right. And let's just take a moment to talk about your campaign. I forced you into talking about these national political issues. Rachel was on our show, was it about a month ago?
Yeah.
I think it was right in the middle of the holidays. I think it was about a month ago. And I, with my mind association, I keep calling her Robin Ventura and Ace Ventura and all this stuff. But Rachel Ventura, Jesse Ventura, you're running the 11th Congressional. It's a primary, so you're running against a Democratic incumbent, Bill Foster. And the reason you happen to be at the Sun-Times today, and I said, come on into the studio, is because you met before the editorial board, you and Congressman Foster. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, so right off the bat, you know, they talked about us, our top issues, and I was disappointed that Foster talked about AI, artificial intelligence, as the number one issue. And, you know, rightfully so, I said to him, as a scientist, you should be embarrassed that climate crisis was not your answer, because that is the issue. And then that trickles down into the wealth inequality we have and how it's going to hit people hardest who are poor, people of color, people who live on the coastal lines, people's jobs who are in the fossil fuel industry right now, refineries, and the Green New Deal would help alleviate that for those who are going to be hit hardest. And the fact that he didn't even talk about climate at all in the top three issues. He talked about opioids, he talked about artificial intelligence and infrastructure. And at the end of the day, he's out of touch. He's the 34th richest person in Congress. He's a multimillionaire. He doesn't understand what the struggles of most people in his district. I'm a single mom. I work two jobs. I know what it's like to balance, do I pay for healthcare or do I pay my electric bill?
And so is your sense when you go out and you meet editorial boards like the Chicago Sun-Times, which is a little different audience than talking to me. Let's be honest, a little bit. When you move to the center and you leave the shelter of the left, like this little shelter we have here, this little room, do you sense that there's hostility? Do you sense there's what people want to marginalize you? They roll their eyes at you.
There's the criticism that, you know, can we do this? And that's such a frustrating. And we talked about this last time I was on the show that, you know, they always ask, how do you pay for that? Well, how did we pay for the $22 billion increase in the national defense budget that they just passed? You know, the endless wars, the fact that Trump is trying to get us in a war with Iran. I mean, how do we pay for that? So it's very frustrating when you hear that. But the reality is there are savings. So, you know, Medicare for All came up and the Sun-Times, you know, question me, oh, we've heard the Elizabeth Warren and Bernie side of it, but we also heard the other side of it. And is this practical? And are we just being impatient? Is my generation just being impatient on these bills? That was a question that was brought up. And the thing I have to say about that, especially when it comes to climate, is we're out of time. By the time I get elected to Congress, we will have 10 years to make real change before we see some casualties, like some very significant casualties. So we don't have the luxury of sitting around for the next 70 years debating this. And the reality is the fossil fuel industry has spent the last 30 years trying to hide the fact that they knew their product was endangering everyone's lives. And so when it comes to Medicare for All, yeah, health. Every year when insurance denies the claims of people, 40,000 people die every single year. That's unfathomable. You know, we're supposed to have, you know, the best health care in the world, but then why do we have such high casualties? Why does our life expectancy continue to decrease as our profits or as our pay to health care increases? Mm-hmm. We're twice as expensive as any other country out there with health care, and yet we don't have the same coverage for most Americans. It's unfathomable. Yeah. So the time thing, it's important. Lives are on the line. So yeah, we're out of time. And my generation sees that. Millennials and the next generation after me see that. And they know, again, the struggle is that the rich keep getting richer and the poor keep getting poorer. And as long as we allow that to happen, people will suffer.
Yeah, no, I hear you. It's so funny. You're impatient. I mean, I'm an old geezer. I've been waiting for Medicare for All for the 50s. Well, I was just a little kid. Even I was just a little kid in the 50s. But I mean, so I don't buy into the impatience at all. I mean, why aren't the rich guys who are, when they want tax breaks, why aren't they impatient about their tax breaks?
Right. Yeah. Well, you know, the other thing about this, too, is, you know, I think we talked a little bit before about old power versus new power. And new power is the ability to get resources yourself, whether it's education, money. In the past, old power, they would reserve that. They would gatekeep that, right? You had to go to a priest to have someone read the Bible to you. You had to go to the rich or, you know, highly educated to get your answers. And only certain people could go down that path. Well, with modern technology, we all have the ability to check out WebMD and then be an advocate for ourselves when we go see our doctor. You know, we can look up information. We can, you know, learn to read very easily now in public schools. And so this allows people to take control of their lives. And so when I hear that argument about, oh, people are just impatient, no, I think they're more informed. Yeah. I think that they see what's happening and they're tired of having the wool pulled over our eyes. And we're saying, no, stop putting our taxpayer dollars in the fossil fuel industry, into big pharma, into the military industrial complex, and start putting it back in people. It's our taxpayer dollars. They should be coming back to our communities, back to projects that help us.
Okay, Rachel Ventura, she's running for Congress in the 11th Congressional District. We're going to, Dennis has got a bunch of news he wants to read. Rachel, stick around. Maybe she has a few thoughts on the news of the day.
Rachel, where can people find more info about you?
Electventura.com. Thank you, Dennis.
You're welcome.
by the way, Rachel, can we just take a pause? Look at that young man with that tie, huh?
They'd be a fool not to hire you.
That website one more time.
Electventura.com.
All right.
They would be a fool not to hire this young man, but he would still be on the Ben Jarofsky show, right, D?
Yeah.
All right. He had best of both worlds. All right, young man, speaking of which, he's the pride and joy of Alton, Illinois, and as Rachel Ventura can tell you, back in Alton, they call him Dr. Doobie. What's the news, young man?
Nobody calls me that. All right, everyone, let's unpack the news that's happened. happened in Chicago and or Illinois this week thus far. And it's this week's hottest dance craze in Illinois. All together, everyone, let's all do the Illinois Senate Shuffle.
Slide
to the left.
Oh, yeah.
Slide to the left again. Guys, it's a real easy dance. They're all Democrats. So just slide to the left over and over again.
Well, they moved back to the center a little bit with that one. But anyway, go ahead.
All right, enough dancing.
We got to get down to business.
Illinois Senator and Illinois Senate President John Cullerton has officially resigned. After Sunday's vote, we now have a new Illinois Senate president. It's Don Harmon. More on that in moments. But first, Ben Jarofsky, you know how fast the news cycle goes these days. Unless we find out he did something very corrupt, which in Illinois isn't impossible. But John Cullerton will soon be yesterday's news. Any final political words that you'd like to say about the now resigned Senate President Cullerton?
Johnny Cullerton, north side of Chicago, Democrat, is sort of the, you know, he's a centrist. That's the role he played in Springfield. And more often than not, as I've said before, he was the leader who was called on by Mayor Rahm Emanuel to torpedo progressive legislation like that people in the city of Chicago wanted. We're going to have Troy LaRaviere in the studio a little while ago. Elected school board was something that Troy was advocating many years ago. And it would die in the Senate where John Cullerton reigned. So some of the issues that Robin was talking about on a national level, the struggle between moderate Democrats and progressive Democrats, are embodied by the role that John Cullerton played. Rachel, get your thoughts on this. I'll throw you into the hot seat here. You know, we're a Democrat has power, but instead of using that power to really push for progressive programs or proposals, what they do is they use that power to bottle them up and then tell the progressives, you're impatient. You're just pushing too far to the left. We have to worry about the middle. And this is a role that I've seen Democrats do for years and years and years. Instead of using the power that they have to push hard and force the conversation to the left, they kind of use the power they have to undercut the left and keep things in the middle or move it to the right. Your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think the biggest issue that our state needs to be dealing with right now is the education and property taxes. And so instead of moving our education funding towards coming out of our income taxes, we rely heavily on our property taxes. So something like 14% of our schools, it's funded 14% out of our income tax. The rest is our property taxes. Other states have, Hawaii has 100% out of their income tax. I think California's is creeping up to 70%. But most countries or most states are well over 14%. So the problem is then we create a divide amongst what type of education you get. And then it forces federal dollars to invest in these Title I schools that just can't afford. Joliet has many Title I schools. And so you got Naperville has got a surplus of property tax dollars for their schools. They're literally cutting checks back to people who live in those into the cities. But then you have places like Joliet that need extra funding. Whereas if we had even just 70% of our schools were funded through our income tax, then it would really close that divide. And then the 30% extra from your property taxes, first of all, it would create a very low property tax bill since the number one thing that creeps up our tax bill is our education costs. But then you would still have, you know, maybe a little bit better in areas that are more affluent and versus the ones that are not, but it wouldn't cripple or handicap those schools. Yeah. And so that's really where, you know, that shouldn't be a progressive issue, right? Every Democrat, every Republican should be pushing for good education in the
it
state.
It should only be a progressive issue. Not just everybody. And by the way, Michael Madigan on this particular issue wasn't great for years. He stifled attempts to have a fair tax because he thought it would work against some of his legislators. So it wasn't just Cullerton in all fairness on this particular issue. Maya, you got any thoughts about Cullerton before I go back to Dennis for more news updates?
I am very curious what will happen to the rent control push now in Springfield, because Cullerton was the number one stumbling block for both the repeal of the Rent Control Preemption Act and also the considering the proposed actually establishing rent control statewide. So Cullerton was like the huge impediment to movement on those bills and any meaningful discussion on them. So yeah, I'm curious to see I mean, what's going to happen now? But from what I understand, who is the person that's replacing
Don Harmon from Oak Park? We're going to get in. Dennis is a little more on this.
But, I don't know how connected he is to the real estate industry, but maybe he won't be that different.
Friday, we were down to two choices for Illinois Senate President, Senators Don Harmon and Kimberly, no, not Lightfoot, Light Ford, Kimberly Light Ford. A secret ballot went down on Sunday. Which Democrats were involved in the vote? Shh. It's a secret. But apparently there were 39 of them. The mysterious votes were tallied, and it was Light Ford 17, Don Harmon 22. After the results were in, both Harmon and Lightford went behind closed doors to cut a deal. You got to love Illinois politics. Secret ballots and backroom deals right in your face in the news. Lightford's team offered up their terms. Harmon said, yeah, okay, sure. They moved the vote to the full Senate, and the deal was done. Harmon won the seat. Since the vote, news broke that Senator Kimberly Lightford accused fellow Senator Emil Jones and his father, a former Senate president himself, of conspiring against her efforts to secure the Senate president gig. She felt betrayed, she told the Chicago Sun-Times. Lightford said Jones' father, Emil Jones Jr., had an issue with women. Lightford still saw the Joneses as friends and felt deceived when her fellow senator stood behind Harmon. All right, now to the other Cullerton gig. Don Harmon is Senate president. We got that. Now, who's going to replace Cullerton's actual gig as state senator? Tonight, Illinois State Rep Sarah Feigenholtz is expected to be named to fill John Cullerton's state Senate seat. Democratic members are scheduled to meet at Sheffield's Beer Garden for the vote, as long as it's not that place where they have those big drinks that Eddie Johnson went to, all right? No big drinks.
Series?
Yeah.
I think they should have it at Series. Might make for some interesting discussion.
As long as it's not there. Feigenholtz has already gained the endorsement of key members on the committee, and she has served for damn near 25 years in the House. Ben, what do we know about Feigenholtz, and will she make a good senator?
I don't know about the latter, but Sarah Feigenholtz is your traditional lakefront liberal. She's been a state rep from, I forget what district it is. I know it's around Belmont. I used to see her at Ann Sather's, your favorite restaurant.
Tommy Tunney's fiefdom.
In fact, the last time I saw Sarah Feigenholtz, by chance, I had been hanging out with Maya. We had gone to the inauguration where Lori Lightfoot gave that speech, blasting the alderman. And then I went home and I said, you know what? I need a sweet roll. So I went in a cinnamon roll and I went to Ann Sather's, and there was young Tom Tunney at the same table as Sarah Feigenholtz. She was his guest, if you recall. Each alderman got to bring a guest up. Anyway, so
what was Tom Tunney eating?
I did not see his own rolls.
That was good.
She's good.
That's correct.
Maya will be playing at Zany's next week.
But here's the question then. Who's going to take her state house seat?
Oh, well, that's they're going to cut a deal. And I think I'm just blanked on his name. Posner is his name. And I think they already cut that deal pretty much. You know, it's like there's no real lefties. There's no, she's going to get mad at me for saying this. There's no real Rachel Venturas running. And you know what I'm saying? It's all centrists. And
I ran against the will of my party, so.
You ran against the what of your party?
The will of the Democratic Party when I ran for Will County. Yeah, yeah. They didn't want a leftist running, but the people did.
Yeah. So I'm really curious, like, how would that area, would they go for a really, like a Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren. I'm going to throw Elizabeth some love there, all right? I feel there's been a bashing of Elizabeth Warren. A leftist on social issues in that area, I don't know how, I'm thinking about it. I'm thinking of the aldermen in that area. I'm thinking of the state reps in that area. Kelly Cassidy is a little to the north. And so she always says her district's the most left in the whole state. But really are no Bernie-style Democrats from that area. So I don't know if it's because the Democratic Party has lost its convictions in that area, or maybe people like me of the left are the minority. You couldn't win if that way, but that's reality.
We'll keep you posted on all things Illinois Senate news as today's program rolls along. But finally, Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker.
I'm not a perfect person.
I am so proud of you. And Ben, maybe he listens after all. He may have taken my advice because today on our Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker's schedule, he's not in Chicago. Finally, he's been in Chicago every day at that Thompson Center. Today, he's in Carbondale at the Banterra Center to speak at the deployment ceremony for the Illinois Army National Guard. Then he's off to SIUE Carbondale to speak about Rebuild Illinois and investments in the university. And if he's smart, he'll talk to these downstaters into signing on for that fair tax initiative that he'd prefer get voted in.
Yeah, fair tax is the big political fight in Illinois in the coming year. I don't know if it's going to get the attention it deserves. Rachel Ventura, let me ask you this. As a candidate for the Democratic primary, are you going to run in favor of the fair tax? Are you going to run away from the whole issue?
I do believe that we need to be taxing people fairly. You know, I've talked about a wealth tax, whether it's Warren's plan, Bernie's, or AOC. You know, in 1981, when I was born, we had a marginal tax rate of 70% in this country, and we haven't seen one since those years. So it's time that the rich pay their fair share. So I think the fair tax could have been structured a little stronger, maybe a bigger decrease on the lower end and a higher increase on the higher end. But I am in favor of the rich paying their fair share. So fair tax it is.
All right. And we can't do the local news without
this little light of mine. I'm going to let it shine.
Chicago Mayor Lori Lightfoot is at Rush University Medical Center to deliver remarks on health equity at the launch of Affirm, the Rush Center for Gender, Sexuality, and Reproductive Health. That's what's going on locally. Ventura, one more time.
Electventura.com.
Go check it out. And don't go anywhere. It's the Ben Jarofsky Show live from the Chicago Sun-Times.
Read the Chicago Reader to get up to speed on what's what in Chicago. Culture, food, arts and entertainment, weekly concert listings, weekly event listings, the environment, travel. I can continue, but you get the point. And for all of you Chicago political junkies, raw weekly columns on real city politics from Maya Dukmasova and our very own Ben Jarofsky. The Chicago Reader, free to the public in newsstands throughout the city and online at chicagoreader.com. Read it now and be a more informed Chicagoan.
When you lose a loved one whose wishes were to be cremated, Chicagoland Cremation Options provides your family a dignified and affordable cremation service. Chicagoland Cremation Options helps you bypass the expensive overhead of a funeral home or cemetery by streamlining the cremation directly. It saves you sometimes thousands of dollars. Chicagoland Cremation Options Crematory, just south of O'Hare, 5 minutes west of Chicago. It's a family-owned business operated by my good friend, Douglas Klein. You can find them at ChicagolandCremationOptions.com. One more time, ChicagolandCremationOptions.com.
All right. How did you go from sharing stories over the years to deciding to write a book?
Good question, Mayor. Good question.
All right, that's enough, Mayor Rahm. Welcome back to the Ben Jarofsky Show, live from the Chicago Sun-Times.
Yes, I just got a text from our next guest, Roy LeRavier.
Awesome. You are just a multitasking guy
no,
today.
No, but he sent me an article to read. Apparently, he's been listening to me defending Elizabeth Warren, so an article critical of Elizabeth Warren. I got to read
it. Well, been doing five things at once today. Read that, interview Maya at the same time, and grab Troy when he gets here. Let's do that.
Busy day on the Ben Jarofsky Show. Maya, before we have like three things I have to do with you before we get to what you want to talk about.
Yeah. So let's get through them, Ben, because we don't have that much time left. And I want to talk about something very important. So
let's start with number one.
We got a lot.
Number one.
First Tuesdays coming up at the Hideout on February.
I'm like, that's what threw me.
February 4th.
November.
First Tuesday, February 4th, we've got our great debate show with Carlos Ramirez Rosa, proxy for the Bernie Sanders campaign, and Brandon Johnson, Cook County Commissioner, proxy for the Elizabeth Warren campaign. We're bringing them together on stage. We're going to be talking to them about the candidates they're representing and that they're stumping for out there. We're going to talk about similarities and differences between the two and more importantly, you know, what a winning strategy for the left in 2020 might look like. This isn't going to be some kind of Jerry Springer thing, you know.
Or will it?
No, the point is that, you know, I think you and I are interested in how we can kind of expand the tent around these progressive ideas and rather than just have this be some kind of like who's better, you know, type of fight. So should be an interesting conversation. We'll have some, you know, plenty of room to ask some challenging questions for both of them. And That is, again, February 4th, 6:30 at the Hideout. Give them the address, Ben.
1354 West Wabansia.
That's correct.
And these have been selling out every month that we've done them so far. So I encourage everyone to grab a ticket early and often.
Yeah.
$5.
And perfect timing. Talk about organic here. Like that hand, when I saw the handshake thing go down, I'm like, uh-oh. First Tuesday. Well, it's going to get rowdy. Yeah. We got like Dragon Slayer 19. He weighed in. He said, cage match, cage match.
That's exactly what Maya doesn't want to do. All right.
Yeah. Though this whole thing about the handshake and the sexism and all this stuff, I'm sad to see it personally. I'm sad to see it because this is not helpful or productive for the overall cause, so to speak, the overall movement. If these guys are fighting between themselves, that's kind of my position on this.
I'm with you 100% on that one. I thought it was I still believe that it was a tactic and a strategy that Elizabeth Warren's campaign decided to employ to exploit something that they'd learn in their polls. Because let's face it, Maya, you know as well as I do that the tactical end of campaigning involves polls, dirty politics, hitting low, and negativity.
And it also you have to ask yourself the question, who is that effective messaging for? Who is it aimed to shore up, to put out this idea that Bernie Sanders might be have some kind of sexist notion of a woman not being able to be president? Who is that aimed at? And that's aimed at white women. That's a strategy to siphon white women away from Bernie Sanders. And they, you know, like, because like, I can't imagine a constituency or a kind of demographic, I guess, of people who other than white women, who would really be like, seriously perturbed about that. Like there are plenty of other issues. I mean, I don't know what the polling is like for Bernie with black voters, men and women, if it's been, you know, what the numbers are separated out. But I just feel like I feel like people in the African American community who are already progressive and sort of on the left side of things, like this thing about, oh, Bernie doesn't think a woman can win in 2020. That's like it's like aimed at someone who isn't thinking very deeply about what's really at stake, mm-hmm. and like the policies and stuff. And I just think that that's like, it's like a, this is like a certain kind of thing that's meant to appeal to white women in particular.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I had a similar thought that it was the product, a strategy that was born out of a focus group or a poll. It's just smelled of one.
Yeah.
And similarly, what Bernie did with his the little script he had people reading about the elitists, linking Elizabeth Warren to elitists. I'm sure their focus group showed that, well, that's where she's vulnerable. She was a Harvard professor. There's a sense that people with higher education are for Elizabeth Warren. So we're going to exploit that. I think both are do a detriment to the larger cause of progressivity. I think that Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren should be commended for the voices they add to the discussions. And I just think these are trivial, frivolous attacks.
Yeah, and I think that people who are paying serious attention to these candidates are not, I don't think these are issues that they're going to change their mind about their candidates over.
Well, what it does is it reinforces certain biases that people have. I'll probably talk about this more with Troy, but, you know, when Hillary Clinton came out today, I don't know if you saw this, bashing Bernie in an interview. I know a lot of people, older people, generally speaking, I'm gonna just throw that out there, who just have a visceral reaction against Bernie Sanders that's left over from 2016. Now, if he's the nominee, would they sit it out? Hard for me to imagine that, but it's just discontent. It makes it more difficult to build alliances, and it's a distraction. So effectively, this just reinforces attitudes that people already have.
Yeah.
All right, let's switch gears to what you really want to talk about.
Yeah.
A very fascinating story that's brewing in the 1st Congressional District.
Oh, yeah. So the Hyde Park Herald the other day published a very interesting story about one of the candidates challenging Bobby Rush. There's three of them running. One of them is this woman, Sarah Gadd. And the Herald found that Sarah Gadd appeared, or people associated with her campaign appeared to be managing fake social media accounts that were supporting Sarah Gadd online. So the Herald published this story that shows that some of these accounts that are frequently tweeting or posting things that are supportive of Gadd's candidacy, like the photos of these, you know, of the like somebody is claimed to be working for the ACLU. And like, it turns out that person doesn't exist. A bunch of the photos that were used as like the profile pictures for these accounts are traced back to like, oh, this is like an actually like an Indian cricket player and not like, you know, a local voter that's supporting Sarah Gadd. Like, that's who the picture is of. You know, other ones, it was like a Black Lives Matter protester in Houston, I think. Like, there was just like random assortment of avatars that are pulled off of pictures off the internet. This is all, the Sarah Gadd's campaign has like vehemently denied that they're behind these fake accounts. But at the same time, a couple of key people in her campaign have resigned recently. And it's possible that it's over these kinds of issues and over the way that she's been running this campaign. But what was particularly funny to me is that yesterday, Sarah Gadd did not speak with the Hyde Park Herald for this story. I guess they reached out to her and she did not comment. So yesterday, the reporter who wrote the story, Aaron Gettinger, was tweeting about the story and the findings, and he showed, you know, examples of these posts that appear to be actually people within Sarah Gadd's campaign that are making these social media posts. And Sarah Gadd ultimately responded to this, to his tweets. And she said, "I failed to respond because I'm busy running this." She's responding to like the reporter and a bunch of other people who were tagged on these posts, including myself. And she wrote, "I failed to respond because I'm busy running a campaign, my nonprofits, and preparing for an upcoming campaign job fair / expungement clinic. I can't respond to daily messages from a tabloid newspaper harassing me every day for comments about meaningless fabricated stories." This is for a political candidate to be calling a political reporter's work in a community newspaper, which is most definitely not a tabloid newspaper, to be responding in this way is like, just seems like a bad call. Like, this is like amateur hour over here. Like, whoever is working on her campaign messaging, this is just like an absurd response. I mean, there's all kinds of ways to deflect and deny that you may be involved in something like this, but the fact that she called him a tabloid is really just very ridiculous. And then she subsequently blocked the Hyde Park Herald reporter on Twitter. He posted a screenshot of that. So, you know, it's kind of, I suppose it's not a very surprising story. I mean, she also the Hyde Park Herald reported that she claimed that she was in medical school at the University of Chicago, and she wasn't. And I guess she's at the law school there. But anyway, the thing that I think perturbs me about all of this and about just this notion of candidates having fake social media accounts, you know, supposedly supporting them and whatever, it's that, like, we all know that, like, elections are now more than ever fraught with all kinds of interference in the social media sphere, that there's all kinds of fake accounts, you know, managed by Russian troll farms and other kind of foreign actors who want to sow chaos and, you know, confuse and discombobulate people. So there's just a general tanking of faith in the democratic process. And it hurts our kind of, you know, civil society and our political culture that there's like so much discord and disinformation sowed in the social media sphere. To have like a candidate participate in this is really like, it's really nuts, because like, I mean, candidates do all kinds of dirty playing, you know, in the process of the campaigning, especially in, you know, in Chicago and Cook County. But like to like add more to the already chaotic scene that is like social media, with like all kinds of fake accounts and fake support groups and whatever, to have like candidates themselves be tangled up with that and doing that kind of thing is really like, I just think it's a disgrace.
Well, it's so hard to believe anything anyway. Yeah. I mean,
and then when it's a candidate doing it, but allegedly, it's like, you know, it's, yeah.
I have this, I sort of a joke, but I kind of believe it as well. I always say, never believe anything, the good things a candidate says about him or herself, and never believe the bad things they say about their opponent in a flyer. You get those flyers. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of my joke that I've been making, and I'm kind of coming to that. I mean, we've seen, I don't know if you've been following this one. This was not on my homework list of things for you to study, but the Bernie Sanders versus Joe Biden issue over Social Security and claims that Bernie Sanders people have made about Joe Biden in regards to his record on Social Security is a classic example of this. And then the counterclaims of Joe Biden about what Bernie Sanders is doing. So we're Bernie Sanders made up a position that Joe Biden had taken in remarks that was clearly erroneous. Joe Biden was not making those remarks regarding Social Security, so Bernie was wrong to do that. Then Joe Biden countered by saying that Bernie had doctored video of him saying things. Bernie did not doctor the video, so Joe Biden's defense of Bernie Sanders' accusations were in themselves inaccurate. So to a certain degree, Maya, you can't believe, you know, once you get into that furious exchange of a political campaign where they're just throwing punches at each mm-hmm. other, it's really hard to make sense of anything at all. But yes, this goes one step beyond that.
Yeah, and the bigger issue here, again, like this woman is one of three candidates challenging Bobby Rush. The other ones are Robert Emmons and Amina Matthews, but they're trying to take out Bobby Rush.
Yeah.
Like the Obama stumbling block, tell people about what Bobby Rush means and what an attempt to challenge him in an election really entails.
Wow. I could go on and on. I'm really going to try to focus on this one, Maya, because Bobby Rush, when I just think of Bobby Rush, it opens up so much history. That's really history that I've lived through here in the city of Chicago. Bobby Rush first became well-known to the public in the late 60s when he was one of the leaders of the Black Panther Party in the city of Chicago. I don't know if he was the number two or number three to Fred Hampton, but he was high up there. He was very young. He was in his early 20s, I want to say. He had just gotten out of the military. He was in the Army. He's from the north side of Chicago, and that's where he was raised. And when Fred Hampton was killed in a police raid, Bobby Rush had to go underground. He was very concerned that the police were going to come after him next. And I remember I just was a little kid reading newspapers, and I was obsessive then as I am now, that it was like Jesse Jackson, a very young Jesse Jackson, was the one who gave shelter to Bobby Rush. I was very concerned that he himself, Bobby Rush, would be the next victim. And so he emerged with certain bona fides as a result of that, like a courageous voice for Black empowerment. who would stand up even at the risk of losing his life. That is currency, political currency, Maya, that is not cheap. It means something. It's very valuable. And so fast forward about 13 years later, I want to say, Bobby Rush first ran for office. He ran for alderman in, the second ward. And he beat the incumbent, and he was aligned with Harold Washington. And so, again,
so he was in the city council during the Washington years.
That is correct. Okay. He was elected in 1983 to the city council. He was part of the Washington movement when Harold Washington was, this is ancient history, but when Harold Washington was elected mayor of the city of Chicago, it did not just mean that there was a change at the top. Harold Washington swept out of office, I forget, like five or six, I want to say, black aldermen who were loyal to Jane Byrne. Mm-hmm. And one of them was, I believe his name was Barnett, can't believe I remember that, who was the alderman that Bobby Rush defeated. So mm-hmm. Bobby Rush was very much a Harold Washington ally in the city council throughout the 80s. And then, irony of ironies, in 1992, Harold, of course, was dead. Bobby Rush ran against an incumbent congressman named Charlie Hayes, who was a labor leader. And Charlie Hayes had been a very close ally of Harold Washington. Harold Washington is the reason. Harold Washington had held that seat, first congressional, and he basically ushered it over to Charlie Hayes, even though most black nationalists were for Lew Palmer. This is ancient history that only I remember and a few other old timers. But the point is that Bobby Rush showed he had political chops. You know, he knew how to organize a campaign, run a campaign, at least in the black community, and he used that reputation I talked about from the Black Panther days to defeat Charlie Hayes. And since then, he's been unbeatable. In 2000, as you pointed out, a young man named Barack Obama had the temerity to run against Bobby Rush, got clobbered.
Yeah. He's a beloved figure. And in terms of in terms of his legislative sort of history, you know, what has he done for his district in Congress or for Chicago? What do you identify with him as in terms of his achievements in Congress?
Well, that said, Bobby Rush is, I would not put Bobby Rush in the same pantheon of progressive leaders as Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders or Harold Washington, from his days in Congress. Bobby Rush has been your standard Democrat. If somebody else is proposing something that's progressive, probably supported, but he's not going to be the person that brings it to the table.
Yeah, and he doesn't seem to be somebody who really has forged a career in Congress as like the face of...
No.
The face of it. I mean, it's like not like Luis Gutierrez, who, you know, was like a nationally recognized person in Congress
on
certain issues.
Yes.
Right. I can't think of anything Bobby Rush has been at the forefront of.
That's what I'm saying.
As a congressperson, which, you know, makes it like sort of not surprising at all that he frequently has challengers in these elections. But it's like he knows how to play this game. And so, like, I feel like if you're gonna have the audacity to run against him, like, what, you know, you can't be having like fake social media accounts.
Well, this
like that can be easily traced back and like completely damage your legitimacy. Mm-hmm. Like it's just like you've already got like Mount Everest to climb.
Yeah, no, it's true, and it's also a generational issue, which we could get into as well. Bobby Rush has got to be in his 70s. He's been around forever.
Mm-hmm.
And so, by the way, on local issues, he endorsed Bill Daley. Remember that in the last mayoral?
Ooh, yeah.
And then he flip-flopped, turned right around and endorsed Tony Preckwinkle and was, ripping. He really irritated Lori Lightfoot to no end with a speech he made. I forget exactly what he said, but I remember at the time it was inflammatory. It irritated Lori Lightfoot, and she probably holds a grudge against Tony Preckwinkle ever since. You know, Lori doesn't forget these things. She's a little like me in that way, Maya. We don't forget grudges. It's kind of a confusing, checkered career.
Mm-hmm.
Supporting Bill Daley? What's that all about?
I mean,
supporting on local issues, Bobby Rush, I think of all the great progressive issues of our time that we've written about at the Chicago Reader, Bobby Rush has not been on the front lines of any of those issues. You know, he's been away. He's like a typical congressman in that regard.
Yeah.
He doesn't pay attention to what's going on, except in Chicago, except to drop in from time to time and make an endorsement in a certain campaign.
Yeah, but he's just the congressman. Like that's his role. Like, he continues to be in Congress.
That said, he's Bobby Rush.
But he's Bobby Rush.
He was there in 1969 when Fred Hampton was killed in his sleep. He's got currency. He's got name recognition.
Totally.
And he's got legitimacy because of that. And here's something else. Ma, I'd love to get your feelings on this. This gets into generational issues. Older voters, and I know this breed very well, they're very slow to embrace something new. They wouldn't even embrace Bernie. You know what I'm saying? Well, you know, he's that they get stuck in their ways.
And Bobby Rush is always there, you know?
So it's going to be very hard for a millennial. Yeah, Bobby Rush. I remember Bobby Rush, and there's pictures with Bobby. Same thing. Let's not just pick on Bobby Rush. Jan Schakowsky in the ninth. I don't think any millennial could defeat Jan Schakowsky in the ninth. Older voters would rally to her. Danny K. Davis in the seventh. He's got two candidates. Keena Collins is running against him. And that's an uphill battle. Older voters. They're very loyal.
Well, but the difference with the first district, though, is that this includes like sections of Hyde Park. There's the kind of there's younger people there. There's students there. You know, this is like it's not just like a settled kind of older homeowner population. But that being said, I really think that all of these candidates have. This is like a very hard road, and quite aside from voter, you know, Bobby Rush having like being seen so favorably in the community and whatever, like he knows how to play this politics game, better than anyone. Like, I mean, yeah, of the people challenging him, the candidate that I'm finding that I'd be most curious to see like what their ground game is like is Amina Matthews.
I'll bring her on the show.
Yeah, she's got a lot of history in the community, of a lot of community oriented work, a lot of anti-violence work, and you know, I would say that she's like has a lot of name and face recognition. So, I don't know if she really has a chance.
I'll definitely bring her on the show. See what she has to say. I'm open to new voices like. We just had Rachel Ventura on the show, and just new progressive voices, I think, are very important for the Democratic Party. But again, these attitudes are so strong. I was just listening yesterday. I don't know if, I didn't have a chance to talk to you about this. I'm throwing this at you without any preparation. But the New York Times had their endorsement session, and then where they endorsed Amy Klobuchar. And listen, we couldn't pick one person.
You can't sit on two chairs.
Yeah.
You can't, you know, this is like something we say in Russian, you know. Like,
say it in Russian.
Well, it sort of depends situationally on when someone is doing that, человек пытается сидеть на двух стульях. Like it's a person who's trying to sit on two chairs, which is like, you know.
Well, I just gotta.
I'm sure it's gonna work out great for the New York Times, because you know this is all, you know, here we are talking about it. People are clicking on it. You know, it's fine. But it's just it's bleak.
All right, let's just say something.
It's bleaker than the Tribune endorsing Gary Johnson.
Wow. Whoa.
Mind blown.
You want to hear about spineless moves, you know?
Wow.
Like, the Tribune endorsing Gary Johnson is still, in my book, the most spineless thing any media organization has ever done in this arena.
Wow. I got to think about that. That's I tend to go off on passionate tangents denouncing the Chicago Tribune for endorsing Gary Johnson.
Oh, you can't beat up on them too badly right now.
Well,
though.
Actually, can I just do a shout out to Mary Wisniewski and Charlie Johnson, two of our brothers and sisters in the union.
Yeah.
Let's put that out there.
They're really facing some bleak times right now. So everybody better read the Tribune.
They were here in this studio on Friday. We did an interview. Talking about the changes that the Tribune is confronting since this hedge fund, Alden Capital, bought a majority stake They bought Michael Farrell's steak out, and there's really a threat of layoffs and buyouts and just reducing the scope of what the Tribune could do. And Mary and Charlie did a great job of talking about it. I urge everybody, not now, but to check out that download and after today's show. And I'll say this, I say this all the time. The Chicago Tribune's editorial voice is utterly baffling. Sometimes I think it's just like a parody, and it's just we'll learn later that it was just all some kind of inside joke, and they were really in on it. That's the only thing that would justify some of the silly things they've written. But the journalists at the Tribune, I can't give them enough love.
Yeah, but the issue of the editorial board endorsement. The New York Times endorsing Amy Klobuchar and Elizabeth Warren is absurd.
Okay, so here's a part of what they did was they released, I spent a lot of time yesterday doing this, listening to their podcast where the editorial board members explained why they divided their votes between Elizabeth Warren and Amy Klobuchar and froze Bernie out. That was like kind of, and Biden. But
let's hear it.
All right. But I don't believe what they said. I believe they couldn't make up their mind. I believe they didn't want to take a definitive stand on the battle between progressives and centrists and the Democratic Party, because they're just like the Chicago Tribune in this regard. They didn't want to alienate their readers by taking a strong stand, and they knew that their readers were split, so they just.
I mean, Amy Klobuchar, have you actually met an Amy Klobuchar voter? Have you met a single person who's into Amy Klobuchar? Because I have yet to have a face-to-face conversation. I've met Mayor Pete people. I've met Biden people, Bernie people, Warren people, Cory Booker people, Kamala Harris people. I have yet to encounter in real life, face-to-face, a person who's into Amy Klobuchar.
I'm trying to think if I have. She's on my list of five. You have to do five. I make my list. The guests come in.
You have to do five.
I know. Most of them don't do five. I got to tell you that, Maya.
What do you mean do five?
My top five. So
candidates.
You
still.
Got five candidates. Can you name five Democrats? Put them in order. Like if you had a vote right now, which would your order be? So you're number one, you're two, you're three, you're four, you're five. I say get it down to five. It could change.
So you're saying you haven't even met someone who put them on their five?
Klobuchar is on my, she's one of my five.
But there's like six of them left.
Well, there's actually more than
exactly.
Six. Exactly. Well, actually, there's more than six. There's Bloomberg. He's running.
Tom Steyer doesn't count.
Why does that? You have an interesting. Why does he not count? Tulsi Gabbard's still running, so
okay.
She could be in there.
All right. Well, listen,
Michael Bennett, I believe, is running.
Super evasive, man. I'm asking you. Have you ever met somebody who's excited about Amy Klobuchar?
No, you're absolutely correct.
Dennis, have you met somebody who's excited about Amy Klobuchar?
Not in person. No.
No. Exactly.
Have you ever
met one
not in person?
Why no? Bill Maher goes on and on.
Oh,
about
yeah,
Amy
Bill
Klobuchar.
Maher. That's right. I just
wow.
listened to his.
What a horrible endorsement.
Come on, people. Bill Maher.
Yeah.
Amy Klobuchar.
Yeah, no, that's it. Bill Maher is the only person. And by the way, she's not even in his top. I don't even think he would vote for her. He just.
No, it's because he doesn't want to.
So what do you think that was all about? What do you think the New York Times was all about when they.
No, it's what you said. It's to not alienate too many of their readers. Their job is to sell newspapers.
So why not go for Joe Biden? I mean, if you want a centrist, go for a centrist that somebody's supporting.
I don't know. Because no, you don't really want to, you know, you don't want, that would be embarrassing. His likelihood of winning is so low that like, it would really be embarrassing if the New York Times was like coming out hot and strong for him.
I would say that Joe Biden has a greater chance of being elected president in 2020 than Amy Klobuchar.
Okay, true. But if he loses and they endorsed him, that's more embarrassing than if Amy Klobuchar does, which she will. And they endorsed her. Like, yeah. I don't know.
It was very bizarre. But anyway, one of the revealing aspects of their thought process was revealed in a taping where one of the editors said, I can't remember which one, they were just voices on a podcast, said, that Bernie Sanders can't win, I'm paraphrasing here, because he's supported by young people. And if one thing we've learned, young people don't vote, and this election will be determined by older voters. Young people don't. And they were just dismissing Bernie on the electability issue, and it was just this dismissive, disdainful attitude about young voters in general, and the whole notion, really, that the Democrats can win by doing the things that you've been talking about for months on this show, building their base, generating more passion in, you know, among younger voters and voters who don't ordinarily vote, marginalized voters, as they call them. And they just sort of dismiss that. That's not going to work. It's just, it may get him 30% of the vote.
You know,
Iowa.
I just want to remind everybody, these are the same people who were completely sure that Donald Trump could not win an election. Mm-hmm. So just, you know, like, this is all meaningless. You know, this is just filling up time and space and newsprint with the conversation of the day.
All right. Very good. Maya, before I let you go, anything else you want to say, anything you want to promote, any articles you want to talk about other than of our February 4th appearance at the Hideout?
Just a reminder about the February 4th appearance at the Hideout. Everybody should come out. I think it'll be a good conversation.
I agree. Once more time, Carlos Ramirez-Rosa and Brandon Johnson. Maya, thank you so much. We got Troy LaRavia on deck. We're going to bring him on when we return.